So I think today's hearing of the Senate Judiciary Committee might be like one of the randiest hearings I've heard in a while.
Ooh, do tell.
It's bawdy.
My goodness.
So bawdy hearing. Senator Ben Sasse asked Jim Comey, there's room for reasonable people to disagree about at what point an allegedly journalistic organization crosses a line to become a tool for foreign intelligence. There are Americans, well-meaning, thoughtful people who think WikiLeaks might be a journalistic outfit. Can you explain why that is not your view? And before saying, after saying he wants to be careful not to prejudice any future proceedings that I can or cannot confirm, Comey says, to my mind, it crosses a line when it moves from being about trying to educate a public and instead it becomes intelligence porn, frankly, just pushing out information about sources and methods without regard to interest, without regard to the First Amendment values. Yeah.
For the record,
he's pushing them.
Just pushing that porn out. Intel porn. Take your secrets. Give them all to me. Give me all the secrets.
For the record, Comey's diction was much more like.
Okay, he may not have been as spicy as I was. I love the term intelligence porn.
I used it multiple times.
I love that the FBI director loves it too.
I like it. I like the describing the voyeurism, especially to Congress, who are the worst in voyeuristically looking at intelligence that they don't.
Okay, so intelligence porn creators and consumers. So. But there's like the reality show intelligence porn, which is WikiLeaks, and then there's like the Hollywood intelligence porn that's like Oliver Stone, right?
Yeah.
Well, I think the real question is intelligence porn feminist?
Oh. What's that conversation?
Let me just say that the attractiveness level of this hypothetical intelligence porn might be disappointing to the audience.
Hot, hot code words.
Hot, hot in a basement, windowless, and
hot, skip hot action. Cables.
In a hot, hot skin. A
lot of pasty skin. And
okay, we can stop now.
All right. Hello, and welcome to Rational Security, the intelligence porn edition. I'm Shane Harris of the Wall Street Journal, here to talk dirty to you about polo step.
You're breathing a little heavy there, polo Shane. Step?
Isn't I read that in a code word book once? I'm going to give you some top secret documents.
This is good. You clearly thought through this like a
I'm
lot,
wearing nothing
Shane.
But a burn bag.
What's even better about this is that Shane is sitting in Ben's chair.
I am sitting in Ben's chair. I know. I feel like the king of the jungle studio. Does this mean I have to pour my own scotch?
Yes.
That's not happening.
I'm afraid it does.
Not happening. I'm here in Ben's chair. Ben's away. Ben's moderating some dumb book or something.
And when Ben's away.
Yeah, exactly. We talk about porn. I'm here with Tamara Coffin Wittes, Susan Hennessy, and Quinta Jurassic. Hi, everybody.
Hi,
hey,
Shane.
Hello.
I don't think Ben's book, whatever he's moderating about, is nearly as exciting as the show we have for you today. FBI Director James Comey. You know him. Dirty Jim. I'll just stop. This may become a theme, just so you know. This may be the NC-17 edition.
It'll be like the new, like, the Joe Biden thing that The Onion did. He's this, like, dirtbag. We'll do, like, secretly dirty Jim Comey.
I would pay good money to see that. FBI Director Jim Comey says he was somewhat nauseated by the idea he could have swayed the presidential election. President Trump is reaching out to autocrats and adversaries. Is his strategy paying off? And the NSA reins in some of its surveillance operations. So let's start with Comey. Comey testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, obviously, as we've said. And when he wasn't talking about WikiLeaks and gratuitous display of secrets, the question came up of whether, what was his state of mind when he, as we have talked about many times, revealed to the House Oversight Committee, which then was promptly leaked, that the FBI was looking again at Hillary Clinton's emails and the ones that were found on Huma and Anthony's laptop. And, you know, we don't have to relitigate all that. But said the idea that he might have swayed the election left him feeling somewhat nauseated. So
not flustered, not breathing heavily, but nauseated.
Right. So on election night, he's like, no.
To be fair, many of us felt the same way.
Maybe for different reasons than the FBI director. Maybe not. What did we learn from this hearing? I think interesting, and perhaps maybe even for some people it was cathartic to watch Comey up there talking about what he felt about this sort of decision that was, you know, he had two horrible choices, as he put it. He could either stay quiet and be accused later of covering for Hillary. I think it probably he thought Hillary was going to win, or he could, you know, take the risk of swaying the election or affecting it by speaking out about what the FBI was doing. I mean, did you guys walk away from this feeling that any part of the narrative has really changed here all that much?
I don't think we learned anything new. I think he got a fuller opportunity to explain his thinking and the calculation that he went through. And he made an argument that was basically a balance of harm argument, and that he was concerned about the institution of the FBI and the Justice Department and the integrity of the political campaign. But that latter was damaged either way, and it was a question of how to minimize damage to faith in this institution. So, you know, good to hear, but I'm not sure it changed anything for most listeners. I also think, you know, it was an opportunity for him because in the weeks since he last testified, some former officials have spoken out more about this. So Lisa Monaco, for example, was quoted saying publicly, not criticizing Comey per se, but saying, well, the Justice Department has these procedures for a reason, and they're there for the tough cases, not for the easy ones, and it's important to follow them, which is an implicit criticism.
That's her old boss she's talking about.
Right. So it was a chance for him to sort of talk back to those critiques.
Yeah, so I mean, I think I don't think it changed anybody's minds, in part because like everyone is so hardened at this point into their understanding of the narrative and sort of particular how they view Comey in general. I thought sort of he was remarkably sort of impassioned and emotional in a way about really wanting to say like, I took this decision seriously. Of course we thought about the consequences. Like, I had two bad choices in front of me, and I made the less bad choice, and then I acted with what I knew at the time, and, you know, and yeah, I get what a big deal it was, but like, I did the best I could. And so I thought he was, demonstrated that, you know, look, whether or not you agree that he made the right decision, that ultimately, you know, he acted in good faith. He took this, you know, this seriously, and the notion that he was like in the tank for Trump is sort of absurd. You know, that said, I thought that beforehand. And whenever I look at sort of other people's reaction of the rank hypocrisy of Jim Comey and, you know, this, you know, duplicitous, mendacious liar out there, they're like, right, that was the response to from sort of that wing of Twitter. So it's, I think that, I don't know that anybody really watched that and thought, oh, yeah, I was really suspicious of him, but now, like, I sort of see his frankness and candor. Interestingly, Dianne Feinstein, actually, in the course of questioning, she clearly had sort of a change in questioning tact, because I thought she really sort of backed off what had been previously a really rather direct and aggressive line of questioning. That said, no, one thing that I think is remarkable here is that, you know, Comey, whenever I look at the decision, I completely buy the notion that they were examining, you know, two bad options and these were the choices in front of them. My critique or objection is that they were making those choices with the assumption that Clinton would win. And so they made risk-averse choices, or choices that they thought would sort of preserve their legacy or sort of make them look good and be the most defensible.
Well, they discounted the risk because they thought she was likely to win. But you can say the same thing about the Obama administration as a whole, not only Jim Comey.
So this is exactly my point, that they, like, he sort of left holding the bag here for this decision. But in fact, it was that exact decision that characterized almost all of the Obama administration's conduct, certainly sort of moving up into September and October, of not you know, getting involved here.
Or not making a bigger deal about the Russian interference.
Well, which Comey made clear, right, during the hearing. I mean, he had this long sort of speech about the conduct of Attorney General Loretta Lynch and how he felt that she had boxed him into a corner there, and that he ultimately felt that he needed to come forward not only in October, but also in July in his initial press conference, to reassure the American people about the credibility of their institutions, which is sort of an astonishing statement for him to make. I mean, and he did preface this by saying Loretta Lynch, who I like very much. But so he's
not sure he sold that particular argument about why he felt compelled in July to take the step that created the path dependency that led to the the letter 10 days before the election.
I mean, what I was really struck by is, as Susan said, he was really animated in defending himself. I mean, he's quite passionate and sort of explaining his thinking on this, in this sort of, you know, the two doors and you have to pick one, which reminds me, I was thinking of like the lady and the tiger or something like that, except I suppose you have two tigers, or a tiger and a bear or something like
that. Red tiger.
Russian bear.
Is it Cozy Bear?
Which goes your fancy. Who knows? And they both have a gun.
but that he...
That's a really extended
But he said multiple times that it was a painful decision, and he described it as creating nausea in him. Like, he was really taking pains to
underline
the extent to which this was a, like, in the sense of the nausea, literally visceral decision that he feels very, very deeply, which made me think, you know, as we know, he's a fan of Reinhold Niebuhr, right? Like the sort of Niebuhrian sense of that we're all, you know, fallen actors in a tragic world and you have to make tough decisions. I think that was very, very much on display.
I don't get that at all from him. I get more and I think this is part of the critique of him, the more sort of, you know, the Boy Scouts, like, you know, I'm going to the presentation of sort of, you know, always the upright and righteous and just decision. And that I think one of the things that sort of is at least somewhat fair criticism is, you know, you say that you're making the right choice. There is a distinction between examining what is, like, purely what is the right choice and also how that choice will be viewed as to, like, in through the lens of history, right? That there's something sort of self-referential or overly conscious about, like, this
sort of Greek tragedy kind of thing. Yeah, I also feel like at the end of the day, and we've talked about this before, an election that was decided on, you know, 1% or maybe on 80,000 votes in particular precincts is so it can be explained by everything, and therefore you can't say that any one explanation is determinative. And so the sort of torturing Jim Comey over whether he determined the outcome of the election is a futile game. But at the same time, his public kind of expiation of, oh, I was so tortured and
these
choices
exactly
were awful, I don't think that makes anyone feel better about the inevitable impact, even if it wasn't determinative.
And probably not Hillary Clinton, who should point out, the day before this hearing came out and said, if not for Jim Comey and WikiLeaks, I would be your president. Or if the election was held on October 27th. I mean, she's probably sitting there and, you know, just rolling her eyes or screaming at the television watching this testimony,
actually,
right?
I think that there's been a little, I mean, understandable media focus on that dimension of her remarks, but I thought she actually did a pretty forthright job of taking personal responsibility
for
the way the campaign was conducted, for where they did and didn't campaign in those last weeks. But in addition to that, you know, the polls on October 27th said one thing and the outcome on election day said something.
And Jim Comey did not stop her from campaigning in Michigan.
Right, exactly. Look, in a close race, there can be multiple but-for factors, right? Like, but for her not ignoring, you know, Michigan and Wisconsin.
Right, it's just overdetermined.
Right, there's lots and lots of stuff. Is Comey the last factor? Potentially, yes. And so this obsession on what was the thing. Well, it was probably multiple things. The press coverage, certainly. The polls themselves, right? So it's not that, like, the state of the world was one way, and 11 days later it was dramatically different.
Right.
That might have been true, but also it was clear that we just thought the state of the world was one day, 11 days before, because that's what the polls were telling us. Had the polls told people, hey, this is a neck-and-neck race, that would have had different voter turnout rates. People would have made different choices about third party candidates. Like, there's so much here that
Jim Comey might not have done what he did.
Right.
Exactly. The sort of this desire to get back out there and find the one thing. It's like, look, guys, it's done. Like, we need to move forward. If anything, and this is not specific to sort of the Comey responsibility, but just the general questioning about Russia and where we are in general, we could have had this exact hearing 2 months ago. This is an incredibly important issue. It should be occupying huge amounts of congressional time and attention. And yet, somehow, we have not really progressed in what we're focused on or thinking about. We're still talking about what Jim Comey did before the election.
Well, and we're still talking about what shaped the election outcome. We're not talking about what that Russian campaign was like and how it was structured and what it means for now. And that, I think, goes both to the differing political agendas that are embedded in these investigatory efforts in Congress and in the kind of broader polarized environment. But it also goes to the sort of obsession that we have and that our political reporters have with the horse race. We love campaigns. The media loves campaigns because they cover them like a horse race. Everybody loves reality show competitions. And we just can't let this one go. And so, now it's not Trump v. Clinton anymore. Now it's Comey v. Clinton. But we can keep talking about this forever because we'll never actually know the answer.
Although it should also be said, I mean, the horse race aspect and the sort of like always going back to the same thing, Donald Trump is also contributing to that because let us not forget, last night he tweeted, FBI Director Comey was the best thing that ever happened to Hillary Clinton in that he gave her a free pass for many bad deeds. The phony, .. And then 15 minutes later, .. Trump-Russia story was just an excuse used by the Democrats as justification for losing the election. Perhaps Trump just ran a great campaign.
Is there a possibility that, well, we've talked so many times about the extraordinary nature of some of these tweets, but that also gets very close to the line, it seems to me, about a president weighing in on his FBI director who is currently leading an investigation on that subject. I mean, in a world in which at some point in the future he tries to – some finding comes out or he tries to remove Comey, I mean, to what extent can those tweets kind of be held
against
him
later?
Funny
you should ask, Shane.
Look, in terms of actually limiting his ability to remove the FBI director, I don't think that creates a legal bar. I think it's just he's adding to I think Donald Trump still does not fully understand the extent to which he is breaching really important institutional norms. I think that he has not been held accountable by Congress or even really the courts, although they've certainly exerted them, shown a little more muscle in the immigration executive orders decisions. But I think he's failing to recognize that there is a tipping point in how much he's able to really, really violate those standards of independence, weigh in on the FBI director without there being significant consequences. So I sort of view it as like he's putting more and more like straws or toothpicks on something and like eventually.
Well, but that, I mean, that's of a piece with a lot of this presidency when it comes to kind of normative erosion. I think it's just another demonstration that for Trump and for his White House, it's narrative uber alles. And he keeps doing these things and putting out these tweets because it's more important to them to define the narrative than it is to, care about norms or the integrity of any act of government.
All right. So speaking of President Trump, President Trump and President Xi Jinping of China, besties. Now besties, got to know each other very well.
The chocolate cake, which
chocolate
both
cake.
Of them love chocolate cake.
Right.
So
President Trump and President Al-Sisi in Egypt, tight, bros. President Trump and Kim Jong-un, open to a meeting.
He would be honored.
He's a smart cookie, according to the Trump.
He's a smart cookie. And
yeah,
he
just
didn't
like
have it
rise
easy
to power
either.
That way.
No,
he
did
not
have
it
easy
growing up as
easy
the son
up.
Of a dictator who was going to inherit the dictatorship. That's rough.
Right. I mean,
those anti-aircraft guns are hard to maneuver.
Wait, wasn't the brother first in line? I'm not like...
Yeah, he was first in line, I think. There was somebody else. He may have been blown up by an artillery cannon and fed to alligators or something like that.
It's not easy to ensure that that you are, in fact, the next in the line of succession.
That's right. A lot of people you got to kill. You killed a lot
or
of people.
Just one.
Yeah, exactly. The big one. So the president has made this, it's become a pretty clear pattern, I mean, of reaching out to adversaries, autocratic regimes, governments, sort of being open. Obviously, his detractors have said, have had a lot to say about this, and is the idea that we're somehow putting Kim Jong-un on the same level as other leaders that we would deign to meet with as the United States versus, or is it just being a very flexible, transactional president who's willing to renegotiate our alliances and our relationships with people, and he's open to all conversations? I mean, this is, on the one hand, this is probably not that surprising, right, tomorrow, that he would be saying something like, yes, I might be willing to meet with Kim Jong-un, and I'd love it if Rodrigo Duterte would come to the White House. what's your read on, is there a strategy here, or is this more just kind of impulse, flying by the seat of his pants? And what are the actual, like, the real-world policy implications of this, separate from sort of whatever worldview Trump might have?
Right. So, I don't think that there's necessarily a planned strategy, although I do think I think you're right to say that this is a president who has a very transactional approach to international relationships in general, therefore is willing to look past linkages between issues. So, for example, the argument that in many other administrations has been hashed out that, well, if we overlook his domestic abuses today, he may be a good partner today, but he'll be overthrown tomorrow, and that's bad for us. Those sorts of short-term, long-term arguments about the linkage between domestic abuses and stability or reliability aren't going to wash with a guy who is short-term and transactional in nature. But I do think there's a lot of conversation about these contacts that's about values versus interests. And in fact, Secretary of State Tillerson, speaking to the State Department earlier today, made a really big point about saying we have to distinguish between our policies and our values. Our policies are linked to our national security and our economic interests, but our values are always our values. They're not going to change, but our policies have to be connected to our interests. In other words, this values-interest dichotomy is very, very real, and we're always going to come down on the side of interests. So that's, you know, that's a good realist tradition in American foreign policy. And you can make arguments for that. You could say, well, cozying up to Xi seems to be getting more out of him on North Korea than perhaps confrontation with the Chinese might have done. You know, that it looks like Xi called Duterte in the Philippines the other day to talk to him about regional security, including North Korea. You could argue that cozying up to Sisi won the release of this Egyptian-American woman who had been in jail without trial for 3 years. So there is a realist argument to make that engagement does better for you in the long run than confrontation. But I actually think that what we see from Trump goes well beyond mere engagement on behalf of American interests. When you have a president, and presidents don't normally call foreign leaders to congratulate them on domestic referenda, when you have a president who calls right away Erdogan to congratulate him on a referendum that centralizes power under him and allows him to continue running for office, or not just calling Duterte, because he was making a round of calls of Asian leaders, but calling him and inviting him to the White House without checking with anybody on his staff or coordinating with anybody. You know, this is a kind of going beyond mere engagement. It seems to be a sort of love affair with strongmen, the way he talks about Putin, the way he talks about Sisi.
Because it's not like he talks about Merkel this way.
No, to the contrary, he called Putin the same day that Merkel was in Moscow, standing side by side with Putin at a podium and criticizing Putin for his crackdown on gays and lesbians in Chechnya. So it's really, you know, there's a really, really strong contrast, not just between how Trump treats Democratic partners and autocratic partners, but how Democratic partners treat those autocrats and how Trump treats them. And so I do think there's something here that goes beyond any policy argument you can make. It's temperamental. And it goes together, I think, with the frustrations he expresses about those stupid congressional rules, like, you know, needing cloture, or those you know, frustratingly independent judges who keep blocking his actions, he is jealous of the guys who have absolute power.
I mean, I think that's exactly it. And it's interesting that he writes so closely after the vote in Turkey. He starts focusing on all these dang rules that prevent him from just enacting policy. And it's a really bad situation for the United States. It's a lack of respect for process and sort of a desire to expand his own personal power or sort of ability to maneuver,
or even a lack of understanding of the fact that the system of which he is the chief executive is a system of divided authority. Right. Like, it's just a fact.
It almost feels like he's sort of calling members of, like, what he perceives as members of his fellow club, right? I mean, it's like we're all in the World Leaders Club, and so therefore I'm willing to talk to anyone.
Well, so the interesting thing is, why is it useful to have a guy like Duterte in the World Leaders Club? What does Duterte get
Duterte,
you?
Duterte, who after the invitation was extended, said basically, thanks, but no thanks, I'm busy.
I'm washing my hair that
day.
So
he snubbed him, which was kind of like, touché, sir.
The strange thing as well is sort of the justification after the fact. So just like the tweets where he sort of lobs something, you know, he extends this invitation and then everyone has to sort of come up with an explanation. And the White House's explanations here were really pretty strange, that they needed the Philippines in order to help with North Korea.
Yeah, regional security, as Brian said, we need all the partners we can get. It's like, but you don't really need the Philippines
in that
way.
So it's this very sort of strange, I don't know if it's just grasping for sort of anything, to try and explain what exactly is going on here. But it's a very strange and at this point unifying feature of sort of how he views the world.
It's true. There's a lot of inconsistency in foreign policy in this administration. This is a consistent theme. I would say, though, that, you know, the history of American foreign policy and engaging with these autocrats, you know, often they can be good partners. They can help with specific security interests. They can vote with us in the UN. But there is one consistency that we see, which is that even as they do that, they can often be very anti-American in their domestic rhetoric. They blame us for the cooperation that they provide to us. And I think Duterte's snubbing of Trump is a perfect example of that. So if Trump is hoping that he's going to get adulation from these guys as a result of ignoring all their domestic foibles, history suggests that he will be disappointed.
Well, yeah, to Shane's point about sort of the same club, it reminds me of something that the former deputy director of NSA used to talk about, which was like, what is the purpose of power and whether or not it's to rule or to serve, and that this, you know, that American power and American politics, where it's about power for the purpose of service. And so I do think that that's, you, Shane, you're like onto something, and that there's this club of people, their understanding of the purpose of power is to rule, and Trump is pretty clearly in that club.
Well, wait, so what I find interesting is that I think, to Susan's point about the sort of post hoc rationalization of, like, this is the reason why we're doing this, that you actually in a weird way have seen over the past few days a kind of similar rationalization from the left, which is not something that I would have expected, but there's this sort of there's this argument that, well, so now Trump he's, you know, that democracy stuff, take it or leave it. Values, interests will go with the interests. But that the sort of counter argument is, oh, you know, the United States has always just pursued its interests, and it's always been, you know, we've always supported dictators, and is this anything really different? And so, to which the response, I would say, is yes, that if you talk the talk, what, like, that actually does make a difference, that you're not, you know, you can work with Turkey, but congratulating Erdogan on a referendum in which he gains authoritarian power, like, that's a very different thing. And so from Trump's side, the White House is making these arguments that the sort of, well, as a matter of calculation, it all makes sense. And there are folks on the left who are saying, well, it was all a matter of calculation anyway, and this has just ripped off the mask, and therefore it doesn't really matter that this has changed. And the mask is actually important.
Well, I would say, number one, as you said, it's not just a mask. And United States, not mere rhetoric, but action on human rights and democracy abroad, has made a concrete difference in the world. And its absence is making a concrete difference. And you can talk to activists in countries all over the world who will tell you that they already have evidence that the silence from Washington is making their lives harder. But I think that there's another difference, which is, you know, which was really revealed by Tillerson's rhetoric in his State Department speech today, about which I will try to write something very soon. He kept talking about our values, that, you know, we can't expect other countries to adopt our values. And this is what's really shockingly different between this administration and every modern administration that came before it. These are values, and not only American administrations, these aren't just our values. These are values embedded in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Universal Declaration. This is an international framework. These countries, Egypt, for example, is a signatory to these treaties. These are international obligations these governments have taken on. And the notion that we're all of a sudden saying these aren't universal human rights that accrue to people because they are human beings. These are just our values. You might have other values.
It's kind of this moral, suddenly he's a moral relativist.
Democracy, free speech,
this
whatever.
Is the thing, though, is that, like, Donald Trump is, like, on the one hand, this sort of weird backward apotheosis of, like, the American right in the 20th century, like, Frankensteined into existence. But he's also the embodiment of this, like, total relativism, which, for all of the 20th century, the American right was complaining about and saying that, you know, like, Foucault would lead to Stalinism or that kind of thing. And then at the same time, he said, oh, you know, like, values, truth. Does it exist? Does it not exist?
Right. I mean, don't we kill journalists too?
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. So, but I there's think this convergence.
But look. I think there's a distinction between sort of the whataboutism that has always been a feature of the left versus what we're seeing here, which is look, America has always been willing to have a whole journo's relationship with some unseemly characters in order to advance American interests. Though we had a different definition of what American interests were, and so whenever you were making the trade off. For were you going to have this relationship with you know, less than democratic leaders or human rights abusers, it was in order to achieve a goal that comported with democratic values and the positive elements of Western influence and of American influence. And so now whenever we talk about, you know, well, we always just pursued our interests, well, but what? Like, I keep coming back to this point of, like, how does this help the United States of America? They have not offered any kind of explanation for how cozying up to Duterte, Erdogan, how it benefits anybody other than the Trump hotels.
Well, we're gonna get better deals. We're gonna get better trade deals and better security cooperation. That's their argument, and we'll see what the results are. But I think the other point perhaps to leave on the table here is that in addition to the incongruence of these left arguments on the left is the incongruence of the arguments that are made on the right that this administration is somehow an heir to Reaganite policy approaches, because there is nothing that is a deeper betrayal of Reagan's approach to world affairs than this relativism. Reagan believed that these were American values, but he believed that these were the right values for the world and that America was a shining city on a hill. And yes, he did work with dictators, but he also, by the end of his administration, had come to a point where he saw the advancement of these values as useful in our fight against the Soviet Union, and a useful way to constrain other governments from doing things we didn't want them to do. And he went to the point of, you know, gently nudging aside more than one major American autocratic partner.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to our last topic. The NSA. You remember them. Remember the NSA?
We used to talk
so much about the NSA on this show.
Oh, right. They have all the intelligence porn.
Yeah. Big building, terrible They're, parking,
that's right.
Intelligence porn.
NSA is it like Pornhub for Intel porn. It's like they have the best.
This is
the,
really NC-17.
The most, the rawest intelligence. The most unfiltered.
There are so many puns that could be made, and I'm not going to make any of them.
Sure. They make them all the time out there. Right, Susan?
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
So the New York Times reported recently that the NSA has ended a particular type of collection of overseas information, which communications that mentioned a particular terrorist's identity or had an email address of that person. Communications that were about a particular target of surveillance as opposed to communications to or from that target were being intercepted. And this was a quite controversial practice and what was known as the upstream collection program. New York Times reported and the NSA said in a statement that they had suspended that about portion. There was also a Times story today also by Charlie Savage who wrote this other one we're talking about, noting that the NSA was actually bringing in a lot less in the way of phone records now post the amendments of the 215 program, I think, if I have that right. But particularly on this about collection part, and Quinta, I want to ask you to lead off on this because Lawfare's Bobby Chesney did a piece touching on this. There was a PCLOB report, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board from 2014 that 2016, sorry, that made
No, so it's a 2014 report, and then it's updated in 2016.
Updated in 2016.
Okay, the new update.
That made the point that, in their view, it wasn't technologically possible to separate this about collection portion from upstream in general, which also collects information to and from particular targets. And it's not clear from NSA's statement whether or not that means that the NSA has ended the about portion or has ended the entire upstream collection program, which would be an even bigger deal. And Bobby addresses this in the piece. And Quinta, maybe you want to take this on, because I think it's this raises the tantalizing question of whether or not the suspension of these activities is actually a lot bigger than NSA is acknowledging and the Times is reporting.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so NSA released two statements on the matter that sort of completely failed to clarify anything, basically. I mean, one of the statements reads, NSA previously reported that because of the limits of its current technology, it is unable to completely eliminate about communications from its upstream 702 collection without also excluding some of the relevant communications directly to or from its foreign intelligence targets. That limitation remains even today. So, and then there's some other statements on this sort of on a similar point, which suggests, as Bobby Chesney wrote, that the limitations identified by the PCLOB are still in place, that there hasn't been a workaround that's been put into use. So that really does suggest that whatever it is that's happening, the sort of the problem that the PCLOB identified is still very much at play here. And so perhaps eliminating about collection under 702 has also eliminated a substantial amount of to from collection.
Yeah, so look, and I'll like, you know, obviously we'll be careful in how I sort of discuss this, but I think it's, there's a reason why people have to really carefully parse all these various statements, because if you put them all together, there are still substantial sort of outstanding questions about the current state of the program. The thing that I think is actually really relevant in NSA's statement is that where it says, even though NSA does not have the ability at this time to stop collecting about information without losing some other important data, and the topic that Shane and Quinta are talking about is the how large that sum, how large the amount of data that sum is referring to. Without losing some important data, the agency will stop the practice to reduce the chance that it would acquire communications of a U.S. person, rather not in direct contact to or from a foreign intelligence target. So this is their way of sort of restating the PCLOB report issue, which is that you can't eliminate for technological reasons particular forms of about collection without also losing to from collection, which is, you know, sort of clearly legitimate within the rules and a relatively important form of collection with some significant counterterrorism consequences. So this has been really this is a pretty surprising announcement. So the issue has been well known, and sort of the debate has been well known by people sort of in and around the intelligence community for a while. So it's not out of left field. That said, it's surprising that they've reached this decision. As Charlie Savage reports, that there was this sort of outstanding question that that PCLOB had raised about whether or not there was a way to sort of to eliminate or reduce about collection without eliminating to from. the technology wasn't available, the sort of risk calculus at that time was no. Then there were compliance issues that were reported in 2011 regarding sort of the querying of this collection. A compromise was reached with the courts in terms of how what the guidelines and procedures were going to be for the treatment of that information. Now it's come to light that there were inadvertent violations of those rules, right? So the rules they'd put in place to sort of try and reach a compromise that basically hadn't solved the issue that they were attempting to solve. And so there was a new assessment saying, well, what would we need to do in order to resolve the court's issues here to come into compliance and to be certain that we are in compliance at all times? And is it worth it to make those changes? Or is it better to just stop doing this, even though we know, and as they say outright in their statement, we're going to lose some stuff that matters? This has been, the decision has sort of been received, certainly in the privacy and civil liberties community, by, aha, you didn't even need it, right? Like, you said that this stuff was really, really important to your counterterrorism mission. This proves that you guys were full of it. Wow, I can't believe this, right? I think that really doesn't understand what's going on here. And I say this without actually making an underlying comment on whether or not it was a good idea or bad idea to take this step, in part because I'm not sure I've come to an ultimate conclusion, and also because I'm missing some of the relevant pieces of information. But that's that. Just because NSA is willing to eliminate a program, they're willing to say the costs outweigh the benefits here, that doesn't mean that there weren't benefits, and that doesn't mean those benefits weren't significant and didn't have security, won't have security consequences now that we don't have that information. And essentially, you know, whenever we should welcome the fact that the IC is constantly engaged in this balancing test. We don't want them just to engage in collection just always because more. We want them to have a sense of risk management. I mean, they've actually created an office with this function now of saying, like, when are we better off accepting the risk instead of just constantly asking for more? If you continually increase the cost of something, eventually the costs will outweigh the benefits. And so I view this as, hey, this particular program reached the tipping point. All right. Like, you know, reasonable minds can differ as to whether or not this was a good outcome or a bad outcome. But the trends here still seem, I find them sort of frankly disturbing, the reception disturbing.
This is what I'm puzzled by. Why is this disturbing? Any of these mechanisms, these surveillance mechanisms, are balancing security risks and political risks or civil liberties risks, which become political risks. And what's happened here is that the balance between those two things shifted. We don't know whether that's partly because the security risk calculus shifted. We do know that the political risk calculus shifted. But without total transparency in their decision-making process, we don't know. It might be that both parts of the equation changed and not only one. And so I don't know that we can distinguish and say this is a troubling trajectory, because the risk calculus matters too. A. B, you know, as you said, it's risk management. Realistically, all of these policies involve risk management. The problem is that our public discourse about them doesn't allow us to talk about that. We simultaneously demand that the government do literally everything it can possibly do to prevent attacks, and that they not do so much that we feel imposed on. And as long as we continue, we as a public, to insist on two contradictory things, they're going to have to decide the balance on their own, with some pushes and pulls from courts and oversight boards and whatever. And so that's the nature of the game. This public statement to me sounds, and forgive me for being crude, sounds like a bureaucratic ass covering statement. Like, hey guys, we had to balance some risk. And guess what? There might be, we're not saying there will be, but there might be a security cost to this. So if something happens, don't come back and eat us for lunch. That's what they've done.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think that's a different way of describing essentially the same thing. And so, sure, I there are complex reasons, and part of it certainly is ass covering. I welcome that they're having this degree of sort of clarity on their decision making, which is pretty rare and pretty new for the agency. That said, yes, I think that this is a piece of it. I more see that the trend is, I sort of think of it as like security policy, as if you give a mouse a cookie, that little kid's book where, like, you give the mouse a cookie and then he asks for a glass of milk and then he sees the fridge and so he wants some pen and paper and then he wants some crayons and then he wants to, like, I don't know, it goes on from there, and it's more and more and more and more. And that is the relationship and the posture that has now developed between essentially the intelligence community and the civil liberties and privacy community, which is a distinct group that is not representative of the American people, because the American people get to set whatever rules they want for the intelligence community. But that we have now engaged in this place in which there's this view that you can always add more. You can always add more transparency. You can always add an additional warrant requirement.
You can also always add more surveillance tools. You can always extend your reach of intelligence collection just a little bit more if you're given the authority. So I feel like give a mouse a cookie cuts both ways. The intelligence community always looks for more than it's got as
sure,
well.
Sure. The difference is that whenever we're looking at the trend lines for the past 5 years, they've only moved in one direction. I think we're reaching a point at which we're starting to see important programs, programs with real benefits, going by the wayside. I think we put lots and lots of compliance weight, only some of it meaningful, lots of it symbolic, and the each time there is a concession, even really substantial concessions, they are never viewed as concession. It is never viewed as, okay, this is risk acceptance. There's some degree of loss, but this is it immediately the clock resets to you didn't need this in the first place. I don't know where it ends, and especially with sort of 702 reauthorization on the horizon, a place in which, you know, frankly, I think it would be catastrophic to the United States if we went down on all of 702 collection. And I think that's not that possibility is larger than zero at the moment, which is frightening. That something about the way we are having this conversation, something about the way these changes are being received, I do not see that trend towards let's put more and more and more into the sort of this compliance machine without being thoughtful about it, without being thoughtful about the operational consequences. I don't see us ending up in a good place.
Which, given the present control of both branches of government, is kind of a surprising outcome.
Yeah, I mean, it's frankly, it's shocking to think that there's a Republican majority in the House and Senate and a Republican White House. And we're saying, I don't know if 702 is going to be reauthorized, guys. That's a real question. I mean, that's just like, it's mind-boggling to think
Devin
about.
Devin
Nunes, like,
and
how
the EFF
all...
standing arm
yeah,
in arm.
That's
at the
your
barricade.
Band name, man.
Oh, we're going to get to the band name. You're not going to like it. But let's move on to object lessons before we get there. You've actually got my object lesson on your phone, which is our glamorous photo of me and Susan and Tamara at the Samantha Bee, not the White House correspondence party.
And I will just say that you look fine in a tuxedo.
Thank you.
You clean up
thank
nice,
you. Thank
man.
You. You guys looked great in your – well, you were wearing purple and you were wearing fuchsia.
Tammy, like, matched the carpet.
The purple carpet.
It was
gorgeous.
It looked entirely
like
really
coincidental.
It was
your party.
Yeah,
it was my party, actually.
It was great, yeah. We were, like, representing with Rational Security in there, and special shout out to Pat King, supervising producer for Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, who
threw a hell of a party, man.
Threw a hell
it
of a party,
awesome.
Just for us, aww. Just for us, and 2,000 of our closest friends. No, it was great. It was really fun, and it was great to. We did all clean up well, and we had a nice time. And
we raised money for Committee to Protect Journalists.
That's right. Committee to Protect Journalists was the beneficiary of all the money and the at a great party. And the actual White House Correspondents' Dinner was not that bad either. I went to the dinner, sat next to John Brennan and his lovely wife, Kathy, Ron White was at our table. That wasn't awkward at all.
See, and they're going to be allies now too.
Yeah,
just wait and see.
We're dog and cat are friends.
Who's the dog and who's the cat?
So they can decide for themselves.
Don't delve too deeply.
It's frog and toad.
Frog and toad. Whatever. But no, actual dinner was pretty good, and you know, it was actually just a night to celebrate journalists too, and I didn't mind that there weren't that many celebrities there, including a certain one.
You're swilling fun. Journalists.
Yeah.
What an awesome crowd.
Or just cheap wine.
You know. The other chefs didn't pay for wine at the table.
I felt so fancy.
I did too, yes.
Who else has an object?
I have an object lesson this week. Since Ben is not here, I will present it for the both of us. So both Ben and I had the very exciting experience of helping one Jane Chong put together what I will say is a truly stupendous resource page on the Russia connection over the past few days. It is truly nuts. It is still in the beginning stages, so there more will be added. But it is basically Jane's rundown of all the hard facts that we have about connections between the Trump camp and Russia, and Russian interference in the election, organized by subject matter, and then by timeline. It is totally bananas. It is incredibly useful. I have no idea how Jane put something so...
serial killer obsessive.
Yes, yeah. In such a short amount of time.
I'll let you know,
that's a compliment, it is impressive, Jane, if you're listening.
Impressive and is bookmarked for me. Yeah.
Yes, so you can find it on Lawfare under our special features menu. I would highly recommend that you go look at it, because for me, I've been thinking a lot recently about disinformation and how it's sort of propagated on Twitter, specifically on the internet more generally, and how the question of the Russia connection is sort of uniquely well suited to it at this point in time in social media and the sort of ambiguous, inchoate nature of the connections itself. And I think this page that Jane has put together and on which Ben and I sort of offered an assist is a really useful way of cutting through the smoke. So
go Jane.
Go Jane. It is awesome.
Serial killer obsessive.
But in a good way.
Don't get on
Jane, that's your letter of recommendation.
So my object lesson is a picture. It is a picture of a toilet. Mm-hmm. Now, not any toilet. The location of this toilet is critical because it is in a bathroom. Instead of
one hopes.
Well, you say that, but the location of this toilet previous for the past 6.5 weeks has been in the middle of my bedroom because we have been going through the world's most ridiculous bathroom renovation.
Oh, no.
And my object lesson is the toilet where it belongs in a finished bathroom. And Ben and Quinta, who I know will be heartbroken at not being able to hear me come in and give them very detailed updates about my ongoing construction saga. I know their hearts are breaking.
I'm just devastated.
They're just dying to hear me complain about this.
Sounds
a little
like it was
bit
a
more.
Crappy experience.
But
oh, so cheap.
Our national nightmare is over.
You can
there is once again security.
Is done.
<They're> secure. Well, we're happy for you. And
thank
remind
you.
Me never to use your contractor.
Use your toilet in peace.
Yes. So shout out to my coworkers.
Very patient.
Well, that brings us to the end of the podcast. Rational Security is a production of Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. You can find our show archive at spaghettionthewallproductions.com. Download the podcast at Stitcher, iTunes, wherever you do. Please leave a 6 or 7 star review. They have that, right?
11, six, you want.
There's like a 46 star review function. Yeah, there's a button for that. Like, right, do the 5 star review and then like do star emojis in the review comments, and then post another one doing the same thing. You know the drill. You can follow us on Twitter at RATL Security. You can find us on Facebook. We're everywhere. Our audio engineer is Quinta Jurassic. Our show is produced and edited by Jen Howell. Our music was performed this week by Jim Comey and Barely Legal Upstream Collection.
Oh no.
Well done.
Right?
Right.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
No, of course our music is
Did someone dared him to say, like, how many times can you say the word porn in your testimony? And he was like, I bet I can do it three times.
He was just really tired and punchy. That's my
He made lots of jokes. He made jokes about his dentist.
He probably hadn't slept in days.
Yeah, Jim Comey's over it, man. He's over it.
YOLO.
Of course, our music was performed by Sophia Yan, who maybe for the last time, actually, after this podcast. We're going to get, like, we're going to earn that E today.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Sophia, as always, for sticking with us. On behalf of my good friends Tamara Kaufman-Wittes, Susan Hennessy, and Quinta Jurassic, I'm Shane Harris. We will talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.